Good afternoon and welcome to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. I'm Lindsay Maynard. Today we take you to the Goldfarb Center at Colby College in Waterville for an address entitled The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of the Independent. The speaker is Linda Killian, a journalist and a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Killian writes for Politico's The Arena, U.S. News and WorldReport.com, and is the former senior editor of All Things Considered, where her main responsibility was the editorial content of each evening's program. This program was pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. This program will be archived on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand to hear the program again at your convenience or to access many other past Speaking in Maine programs. This program will also be available as a podcast. Introducing our speaker today is Sandy Mazel, director of the Goldfarb Center at Colby College.
Good evening. I'm Sandy Mazel. I'm director of the Goldfarb Center for Public Affairs and Civic Engagement here at Colby. And it is my pleasure to welcome you all tonight to this event, and particularly to welcome Linda Killian to the Goldfarb Center and to Colby. Linda's a graduate in journalism and political science at Boston University, who holds a master's degree in public administration from Harvard. She is a Washington-based journalist and a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Linda's been a columnist and writer for the Daily Beast, Newsweek, Politico, U.S. News and World Report, and Politics Today. She has also written for the Washington Post, the New Republic, and the Weekly Standard. In fact, it's hard to think of something that we have all read that you haven't written for. To me, what I'd love to have read is that she is a former senior editor for National Public Radio's All Things Considered, where she was responsible for the editorial content for the National Evening News. So I think I listened to the news that she edited for years and years, however many years it was there, as I listened to All Things Considered every evening. Prior to that, she was a reporter at Forbes magazine in New York and at several daily newspapers, major daily newspapers, including the Oregonian. I read Linda's first book some years ago called The Freshman, which is a book that chronicles the experience that the congressman who came to power in 1994, I'm looking at Becca, who was writing a paper about those congressmen who came to power in 1994 and how they raised money. That was the year, of course, when the Republican Party took over the Congress, and her book received and deserved, I think, critical acclaim for its analysis of how then Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich attempted to use his newfound powers to forward the political agenda on which he and his colleagues ran for office in 1994, the Contract with America. That was a very important time in American political history, and where Speaker Gingrich, I think, used the powers of the speakership in a way that nobody has probably since either Joe Cannon or Boss Reed or somebody of that nature, but certainly for a very long time. And those of us who agree or those of us who disagree with Speaker Gingrich, I think all would say that the way he used his powers was quite incredible during that period of time. Tonight, Linda is here to discuss her new book, The Swing Vote, The Untapped Powers of Independence. While Linda's book discusses the potential power of independence around the nation based on a series of interviews that she did in a number of different states, it seems to me particularly appropriate that she is here in Maine and with us tonight at Colby to talk about this particular subject. For some time, more than a third of Maine's voters have been unenrolled, that is, not declared as a member of either political party. That's the legal way in which we do it here in Maine. Two of our last five governors have been independents. In the last election, an independent candidate, Elliot Cutler, received 38% of the vote and came within 2% of the vote of winning election over Governor LePage. And of course, as all of us in this room know, former Governor Angus King is currently a candidate for the United States Senate, and by most accounts is the leading candidate for the United States Senate seat. Now, independent office holders are not the same as independent voters, but in Maine at least, for a number of years, the spike in unenrolled voters and the vote total for the non-major party candidates have been highly correlated. And I think we are looking forward those of us who analyze the election to see whether the votes in 2012 continue along the same path. So for those reasons and for many others, I am very glad to welcome Linda Killian to Maine and to Colby. We are all ready to hear what you have to say about this very important topic. Welcome to Colby.
Thank you so much. Great introduction. Thank you. Thanks so much for the intro. So you guys can hear me. Oh, I can hear it, yeah. Thanks, it was a great introduction, thank you. I have to say I'm very impressed. I had dinner with, you know, some students, and you guys are a very impressive bunch. So I'm looking forward to your questions. I do think Maine is, in my book, I talk about four swing states, the swing vote. Oh, I forgot, just in case I want to read something from the book, I'll take a book out. This is the book. And I talk about four swing states. New Hampshire is one of them. I talk about Ohio as the swingiest of swing states. And of course, it is very pivotal. It's an incredibly important swing state. But I think Maine could be one of the most independent states. It's not necessarily considered a swing state because in presidential years, it typically, when was the last time it voted for a Republican in a presidential election? A long time ago, decades ago. In 84, in 80 and 84. So that's a long time ago. It reliably goes for Democrats. But for governor and for in the Senate and in the House, you've had Republicans, but you like moderate Republicans in Maine. You know, you like centrist candidates of both parties. And Ross Perot got his highest per capita vote total in Maine in 1992 of anywhere in the country. So I think Maine really likes independents and really likes centrists and moderates. How many of you guys are independent voters, just out of curiosity? That's a lower percentage than most people your age. Young people under 35 are registered as independents in the highest percentage of any age group. 40% is the national average for unenrolled or undeclared, or different states call it different things. But for people under 35, it's even higher. And so that means that more people are registered. It's about a third in Maine, a little more than a third. But more people nationwide are registered as independents than are registered as either Republicans or Democrats. So to me, that means there's something wrong with the system. To me, that's a protest. That means they would rather be independent than be affiliated with one of the two parties. And they give up some rights. For example, in a number of states, in half the states in the country, independent voters cannot participate in the primaries that they pay for with their tax dollars, for you know polls and you know ballots and that kind of thing, and so they don't have a say in who gets nominated. So, for example, independents are watching they have been watching the Republican debates in a lower percentage than either Republicans or even Democrats, because I think they say, well, we don't get a say in who the Republicans nominate. We'll wait, we'll see who they nominate, and then we'll pay attention in September. So there are two sort of, I think they're myths about independent voters, and political scientists, I think, are, I've had a little running debate with a political scientist who reviewed my book, and who sort of said there are no swing voters. They are all secretly aligned with one of the two parties. They're independent in name only. And that is just simply not true. And you know, Andy Smith at UNH, he thinks that. I'm not a quantitative person. I do interviews, but I think the statistics back me up on this. Pew has done a lot of research on this, exit polling. If there are no swing voters, how can you account for the incredible swing from 2008, where independent voters went narrowly, but they went for Barack Obama, and 2010, in which independent voters, they didn't show up in as high a percentage, but they went 19 points for the Republicans. So obviously there are swing voters. By my count, by using Pew Research and answers to various questions and exit data, I think 20% of swing voters, which means almost a quarter of the electorate of registered voters, are what we call the swing voters, half of the 40%. And there's no doubt that they decide elections in places like Ohio, Colorado, New Hampshire, Virginia. Those are the four states that I focus on in the book. Florida is another big one, of course. So they are incredibly important, but I think they're being ignored by the two parties. I think Olympia Snowe's she didn't go quietly. I mean, she you know, on her way out the door, she said the system is broken, and that's why I'm leaving, essentially. And I agree with her. I think for someone like her, and it's interesting because, and this may be a little, you know, we're not, I guess we are recording this, but she and Susan Collins have a similar voting record. You know, they're pro-choice, moderate Republicans. Their voting records are not that different. But Susan Collins was seen as a little bit more of a team player by the Republicans and doesn't get as much grief from the Republican leadership. But they didn't see Olympia. Olympia Snowe kind of went her own way and did her own thing. And she would withhold her vote, you know, and decide at the last minute if she was going to go along with something. She worked with the Democrats on health care reform. Ultimately, she didn't vote for it. But she tried, and that was heresy just to even try. And so I know that the Republican leadership did not care for her brand of Republicanism. And in fact, I did a piece for Politico a day after she announced, and I called someone I knew would give me a reliably juicy quote. And he said to me, well, at least now maybe we can elect a Republican to that seat. You know, he was a Republican campaign guy. Resigning is definitely a statement of how broken things are. And I think the independent swing voters are really tired of being ignored. They're tired of the politicians wooing them. I use this analogy in the book. Again, I'm pulling out all the stops tonight. I'm just letting it all hang out. I use the analogy of a one-night stand in the book because I was on New Hampshire Public Radio today, and the host said, well, if the swing voters, you know, don't get attention, that's all we're talking about right now. And the politicians and the media talk about how will they vote, but then that's it. You know, it's like, you know, wooing someone for a one-night stand. You know, you try to get their vote, but once they voted for you, then you immediately turn your back on them. And it's back to the party activists, the fundraisers, the leadership in Congress. Those are the people you have to keep happy. And so those are the people at the two ends of the spectrum. It's the Tea Party people and the MoveOn.org people, you know, that blog and make noise and carry on if you're not following. Don't you dare vote for health care. Don't you dare help or participate with it if you're a Republican. We want single payer. Don't work with the Republicans if you're a Democrat. So these voters in the middle are a little bit lost, and they're a little bit they're more than a little bit frustrated. I mean, as we see by the performance rating of Congress, which sort of fluctuates between 9 and 11% at the moment. And who are the 10% who think they're doing a good job is my question. Congress can't seem to get anything done. They haven't passed a budget in years. You know, we had the debt ceiling debacle. We had the super committee failure. And I did a piece for The Atlantic recently in which I said Congress is unlikely to do anything substantive for the rest of the year. So it's kind of a sorry state of affairs. I when I was thinking about doing the piece, you all know Thomas Paine, of course, and to me, common sense was, it lit the fuse of the revolution, and to me, that was sort of an inspirational sort of thing to think about, because Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense not for the elites, he wrote it for the people, to get the people behind the idea of a democratic government, republic to be governed by the people, which was the first of its kind, indeed very revolutionary. And I think that idea has been, to a certain extent, lost. I mean, I don't think we have a truly democratic form of government at the moment. As I said, in half the states, 40% of the voters can't participate in the primaries. So I was sort of hoping to inspire these voters in the middle and inspire these independent centrists. So the way I picked my four states, Colorado, Ohio, New Hampshire, and Virginia, and I got to work trying to reach out to these voters. So I got voter lists. It's public information, of course, in states where you register by party. So I called up undeclared voters at 7 o'clock at night, in Ohio, and I said, I'm a reporter from Washington. Do you want to talk to me about why you're an independent voter and what you think of the system? And, 8 out of 10 wanted to talk to me. They were really glad that someone wanted to listen to what they had to say. And they tended to be, not all of them were incredibly well-informed, so it was to a certain extent self-selecting, the ones that I chose to have a longer conversation with. But I found most of them to be very well-informed and very interested in the system and its problems, which again is something that pundits and politicians and sometimes political scientists dismiss, that they aren't very well-informed or that they don't care that much. They wanted to talk. So, I think, I don't know if there are any Ron Paul supporters in this crowd. When did he come to Colby?
Just before the Maine caucuses.
Just before the Maine caucuses. And are you a Ron Paul supporter?
No.
Oh, he was in this building, okay. I think his support is a reflection. He is admittedly a little out there, with some of his, he's kind of all over the map with some of his views. But I think young people obviously like him, and I always say it's not because he wants to legalize drugs. I interviewed, lots of young people who voted for him in 2008 and who said, they like the way he talks to them. He doesn't sound like a politician. He sounds like he's telling the truth. He sounds like he's not sort of giving them BS, which is what they like about him. And I think the support he has gotten, and he has done better, typically, in states where independent voters can participate in the primaries. He did pretty well in New Hampshire, where independent voters can participate. I think it's a reflection of their frustration with the system, and that they want to send a message, that they want something different. Independent voters are turned off by the partisan warfare, the self-interest, the money and special interest influence. And we talked about that at dinner, and you all may have some questions about that. So I wanted to offer a new way of thinking about and looking at the swing voters, who they are and what they want. And I think that is what is being ignored by the political system and the politicians, what these voters want. I don't think the politicians are that interested, frankly. So another thing that I do in the book is I offer a model of who these voters are. And it cuts across race to a certain extent. It cuts across gender. It cuts across age. It cuts across socioeconomic. The independent voters, it's a wide swath. I have four groups that I sort of describe. I have NPR Republicans, who are moderate Republicans. Olympia Snowe is an NPR Republican. Moderate to liberal on social issues, fiscally conservative. A number of them voted for Barack Obama in 2008. There are a lot of them in New England, and they are very turned off by the social agenda, you know, the right-wing social agenda of the Republican Party. But they were also turned off by healthcare, and I think they're very much in play this time. I think Mitt Romney would be a candidate that would appeal to them. So those are the moderate Republicans. We used to call them Rockefeller Republicans, but of course that predates virtually everyone in this room. Nelson Rockefeller's been dead a long time. So America First Democrats are what I call, what we used to call Reagan Democrats. And these voters you would find, I mean, I'm sure you would find some of them in Maine. You find a lot of them in Massachusetts. These are the people that elected Scott Brown to the Senate. In Massachusetts, more than 50% of the voters are independent voters. Think about it. This state that we think of as so liberal, you know. There are a lot of these kind of voters in, I talk about them in Ohio. There are a lot of they would be socially more conservative than the NPR Republicans. They tend to be male. They tend to be lower middle class and working class. They are for a strong defense. They are also very concerned about trade issues because they've seen their manufacturing jobs shipped overseas. In Ohio, you know, it's very interesting. I think these voters are very much in play. And I was just telling my editor this this week because they didn't go for Barack Obama in 2008. They were more Hillary Clinton voters. They liked Bill Clinton. And Barack Obama seemed to them, it might have been partially about race, but elite, too elite, too cool, too not, you know, he wasn't, you know, Clinton was Bubba, you know, he was one of the, you know, he could relate to them. So that was part of it. But what the Republicans have done in Ohio and Wisconsin with their anti-union moves, very unsuccessfully, has activated these voters and has, you know, I communicate with a policeman from Columbus, Ohio, who's in the book and who had been a reliable Republican voter until John Kasich was elected governor and the Republican legislature in Ohio launched this, you know, effort to strip collective or weaken collective bargaining rights for public employees. And he emailed me. I was in Ohio for Super Tuesday week and was speaking at Ohio State and Ohio Wesleyan. And he emailed me and said, I'm volunteering for Barack Obama. And this is a guy who had been a reliable Republican voter. So, and I think, you know, the Obama team is smart. And they get this. And this is why you see Obama doing all these manufacturing visits and having all these, the tax policy, all of the I don't know that it will really work, but he's trying to show that he's doing something about trying to create manufacturing jobs in the U.S. So I think that group is very much in play. A third group that I talk about are the Starbucks moms and dads. These are your parents. these are suburban voters. They are a lot of women in this group. They totally swing because they care about the economy, they care about education, they care about the deficit, they care about health care, they care about keeping the country safe, and they're very much affected by what's going on in their lives. They're obviously affected by what's going on in their children's lives. They voted for Barack Obama, again, not in a huge percentage in 2008, but they swung for the Republicans in 2010. And more than 50% of all Americans live in suburbs and exurbs. So they are the power voters in terms of numbers and because they do swing. And the suburbs, I talk about Virginia and Northern Virginia, which is, you know, the suburbs have become incredibly racially diverse compared to what we think about 30 years ago. I don't, in the book, talk too much about the Latino vote, except that I say in Colorado, you know, in the Southwest, which is also in play and which Obama is really going after. He won Colorado last time. I would suspect he will win it again this time. New Mexico, Nevada, these states have become so racially different and so much in play, younger, that, you know, in some of these states, the Hispanic population is approaching 50%. So it's very different than it was a couple of decades ago. And the last group that I, but I think just to, and the Hispanic vote, I think it's interesting because I think it is not as reliably, I definitely think it's in play. I think Hispanics don't vote as reliably, I think, as a lot of other racial groups. I think black, you know, blacks are a reliable Democratic constituency, especially for Barack Obama. They will turn out in 2012 to vote for Obama. I think Hispanics, it's a little more unpredictable, and I don't think they've settled yet. Obviously, the Republican immigration stuff has turned them off, but I think we can expect, I would be quite surprised if Marco Rubio from Florida, the Republican Hispanic senator, is not, well, Cuban American, is not selected as the vice president. So I don't know what that impact will have. I would presume that will have some impact on the Hispanic vote. And the last group are the Facebook generation. It's you guys. The people under 35 who are registered in a higher percentage of independents. What they said to me was, and I hear it, I mean, obviously there are, I'm not going to look for a show of hands, but obviously there are conservative young people who are reliably Republican, but the majority tend to be more progressive. And a group called Rock the Vote had an argument with me when I was writing the book, you know, they register young people to vote, which is great, but they insisted that young people are progressive, that's it. It's reliable, it's don't talk to me about the middle, they're progressive. But I found the story to be more complicated when I talked to young people. And they said to me, yes, on social issues. And a woman called in today to New Hampshire Public Radio, she was 34, so she's a little bit older than you guys are, that seems old, but and she's in my group, under 35. And she said, you know, I've moved way beyond issues of, you know, gay rights and abortion and all this stuff, this private, you know, that doesn't belong in the political sphere. And I think people your age generally feel that way, and you feel we've moved on from those issues. But you can be more fiscally conservative, and you're concerned about student loans, you're concerned about getting a job when you graduate. And what a lot of young people said to me was they would vote for a Republican. It's not that they would only vote for Democrats. They would vote for a Republican if there was a socially, you know, someone like Olympia Snowe, if there was someone who didn't sort of pound the social agenda, which they sort of couldn't abide. So those are my groups. In Congress, I think, the two parties are further apart. He mentioned Joe Cannon, you didn't mention Longworth, I guess. But I think it's been about 100 years since we've had a Congress this polarized. And I think there are a lot of factors. It's become incredibly dysfunctional. I think open primaries would help. I think the way people are elected is a big part of where we're at. I think gerrymandering, named for Elbridge Gerry, a former governor of Massachusetts in the 19th century. The way the districts are drawn, I think, has a lot to do with the way people are elected. So we only have about 50 truly competitive congressional districts in the country out of 435. And, you know, it's done, to be perfectly honest, I'm not exactly sure how it's done in Maine, but you only have two congressional districts, just like New Hampshire. So there's not a lot you can do there. But in bigger states where there's a lot of monkey business you can do with the redistricting, you know, it's done in back rooms by governors and state legislators. In many cases, the public doesn't even get to testify about the way congressional redistricting is done. And it's done to protect incumbents, and it's done to be safe Democratic and Republican seats so that they don't have to appeal to the center. so they don't have to face a chance of getting defeated. And in 2010, when we think of this being such a dramatic, you know, less than about 15% of incumbents were defeated. So that's I think, a big part of the problem. And the way, and also, you know, the extremes. And I started this book thinking that the two parties were sort of equally at fault here. I think I began the book with that notion, and I remember sitting down with someone at the Aspen Institute who is admittedly a progressive Democrat, and he said, no, you're totally wrong. It's the Republicans. And I said, okay. But, you know, the more I looked into it, and of course the Tea Party has really, you know, risen up and had an enormous impact on the way candidates are nominated and elected in the Republican Party. An outsized impact from my perspective. It's hard to know exactly how many, the Tea Party isn't, you don't register, so you have to kind of guess and exit polling Tea Party supporters, sympathizers. In Ohio, for example, on Super Tuesday, 2/3 of the voters who showed up said they were Tea Party supporters or sympathizers, which left 1/3 for traditional, independents could participate in Ohio too, and sort of traditional Republicans. But I think the numbers are, it's really about 1/3 Tea Party overall in the entire Republican Party, and 2/3 sort of traditional Republicans. But the moderate Republicans, I think, have been intimidated by the Tea Party. And they're not showing up, and they're not making their voices heard. And this, so we see this in the Republican primary, in this kind of circus that the Republican primary has become. And in Mitt Romney kind of twisting himself into a pretzel so that he's unrecognizable from the man who was governor of Massachusetts. You see this in some of the races that happened in 2010 in the Republican primary. Just to name two, there was Mike Castle of Delaware, who had been governor of the state, had been in the House, a Republican quite similar to Olympia Snowe, very moderate, worked with Democrats on legislation on campaign finance reform and a number of things. He was known for his bipartisanship and his centrism and his sensibility. He was challenged in the Republican primary by a Christine, I am not a witch, O'Donnell, a very questionably qualified candidate, who was resoundingly defeated in the general. And Mike Castle would, I think, most probably have been elected to the Senate. But the Tea Party supporters said, we would rather have a Democrat than a Republican like Mike Castle. You know, it's that cleansing, you know, that they're trying to do. In Alaska, you had Lisa Murkowski, who is not super moderate, but she had an 80%, I think, record of voting with the leadership in the Senate. And that was not enough for the Tea Party people. And so she had someone from her own party, and someone mentioned women in politics, and I personally think Mike Castle's not a woman, obviously, but I think part of Lisa Murkowski, I think, was because she's a woman. And someone in her own party, Jim DeMint, sitting with her in the Senate, raised money against her for a Republican primary candidate who beat her. In Alaska, more than 50% of the voters are independents. It has that Western libertarian mindset, I think. And she said, I'm running as a write-in candidate. And she had, obviously, the name recognition. Her father had been governor, who was defeated by Sarah Palin. She won as a write-in candidate. And it has totally freed her up. Now, you know, she's like, well, I'm working with the Democrats. I mean, she doesn't have to listen to the Republican leadership anymore. She doesn't owe them her election. So I think it's a very interesting time. I think there is no doubt that the swing voters will determine the outcome in 2012, and they haven't made up their minds. They are going to wait, and they're going to see, and I think they're going to be very much in play. I haven't mentioned the media. I think the media bears a responsibility here. I'm a journalist. I think the media has become ever more shrill. You have ever more about winning and losing. Who's up, who's down. I think all you have to do is look at the coverage of the Republican primaries. And focusing on the horse race. We hear in the media from the extremes. We hear from the liberals and the conservatives, but we don't hear from the center. You have David Brooks, I guess. I mean, think about how many, and you have John Avlon, who's a commentator on CNN, who is, like me, very much an advocate of independence and the center. And that's it. I mean, you cannot point to anybody who's a pundit who's in the center. I mean, me. But you can't point to anybody who's in the center. And it's a problem. And the rise of, and maybe in the questioning, you know, the rise of groups like the Coffee Party, No Labels, independentvoting.org. I don't know if any of you have looked into this. There's Americans Elect, which is going to nominate a candidate online. They have raised $35 million. I suspect they will be on the ballot in all, if not most, of the 50 states. Most, if not all, of the 50 states. And we don't know who it's going to be. And if you're a registered voter, you can go online and suggest someone. Buddy Romer, the former governor of Louisiana, is at the moment the sort of top declared candidate who is going to, and his issue is campaign finance reform. They have mentioned Olympia Snow, but she has shown no interest. They've mentioned John Huntsman. He says he's not going to do it. So it kind of remains to be seen. But I think they could be a factor in 2012. As we talked about, Ross Perot nationwide got 19% of the vote in 1992. That's a lot. And that 20%, as I said, that's my estimate of what the swing vote is. It's sloshing around. And I think it's looking for a home. And I think those voters are ready to send a message. So I hope they will read the book. I hope you will read the book. I dedicated the book to these swing voters. And I close the book also with Thomas Paine. I use a quote that Barack Obama used in his inauguration speech. We have it in our power to begin the world over again. And I think we do. And I think we need to. And this book is a bit of a plea for the center to get active. Before I take your questions, I'm going to just put in like an ad. So I hope you all will follow me on Twitter. Because, you know, I pick up everywhere, every college I go to, that's where I pick up Twitter followers. And so my Twitter handle, or I don't even know what you call it, is Linda J. Killian. And that is also my website, if you want to check it out, is www.lindajkillian. So I hope you'll follow me on Twitter. I will definitely tweet this event. So with that, I guess I'm ready to take questions. How do you want to do the questions? So you'll like pass it around? Okay. All right. Yes, we have one right here. Someone's ready.
I know you made the argument that once politicians get into office, you know, they spend their whole election focusing on these independent voters, and then once they get into office, they just completely abandon them. But couldn't you also argue that since President Obama's assumed office, I think, from my opinion, nearly every single one of his major policy objectives has been heavily tailored toward independence, from his decision to, you know, pass a smaller than expected stimulus bill, to, you know, a health care bill that was based on Romney's bill in Massachusetts, to the decision to appoint Bill Daley, chief of staff, the decision after the 2010 midterm elections to really focus on spending cuts rather than more stimulus. I also know there's been a lot of research done that shows a lot of the decisions made inside the administration were made in an effort to kind of tailor a lot of their policy objectives toward the interests of independents to kind of keep that independent vote in line.
You know, almost everywhere I speak, and not just on college campuses, but, you know, almost everywhere I speak, a progressive Democrat will ask me that question. I know that that's the way they feel. And what I would say is kind of Barack Obama, and sort of this goes to his kind of wishy-washy lack of leadership, you know. It's like he didn't make anybody happy. You know, he angered, yes, the progressives feel that way, but the conservatives think he's like a socialist, you know. So I think he didn't give them single payer in health reform. So the progressives think, oh, it's terrible. But by the same token, they're arguing in the Supreme Court this week about whether we should you know, abandon the health care reform. And so, I'm very critical of, I think, on deficit reduction. I mean, he went for the Bush tax cuts, you know, at the end of 2010, and didn't do deficit reduction, you know, and I was very critical of that in the book. I tax cuts for everyone, yay, you know, but what does that do? And he didn't endorse his own, the Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction. He like appointed the commission. They came up with what I think a lot of people think, I mean, it's a very serious problem, and we're gonna have to deal with it at some point in the next couple of years. We could have a financial crisis. So he appointed it, and then he said, oh, okay. He didn't reject it. He didn't say they're wrong about this or that. He didn't approve it. So I think, yes, the progressives are a bit disappointed in him, but he hasn't made the conservatives happy either. So, they are making political calculi, I guess. I don't know what the plural is of calculus. All along the way, and he's got a smart team, and, you know, so. But he's no Bill Clinton, I would just say, in terms of triangulation and appealing to the center. So, we had a couple of questions in that row, yeah. Those guys have had their hands up.
So you've spoken a lot about the sort of power of independence in when it comes to the vote. I was also wondering in what other ways they've influenced other political processes, just say with like campaign donations. Do they generally donate?
Well, they don't. And that is, and the last chapter of my book, it's called Battle Cry. And I have what I think are very modest reforms that independent voters could push for. And one of them is make small contributions. You know, make contributions under $100 to candidates that you like, that you think are doing a good job, that are working positively. Because even, you know, look at Barack Obama in 2008. He raised an enormous amount in small contributions, and the internet makes that possible. And so, and even small contributions get politicians' attention. And so that's one thing that I think they should be doing. Some other things I talk about, and to tell you the truth, I kind of forget, open primaries are one of the things I talk about. And I think, you know, in states where they have referendum, they don't have that in Maine, do they?
Citizens initiatives.
And, you know, I think they should push for open primaries in states that don't have them. I talk about redistricting reform. California is you know, always on the vanguard, California. Do we have anyone from California in the room? They have adopted a top two system, which again, I have some reservations about, but I think New Hampshire's system is better, where if you're an independent voter, you can just show up in the poll. And again, I'm not quite sure what the rules are in Maine. You have closed primary. In New Hampshire, you show up, you're an independent voter, you show your ID or whatever, you ask for a Republican or a Democratic ballot, you get one, you vote, and then you come out and say, put me back in the independent column. And so everyone can participate. Now, when I was in Ohio, someone asked me about this, but that means you can only vote in one primary or the other, you can't vote in both. And so if local candidates and state candidates, if you want to vote, you know, in both parties, in California, they've adopted a system where everyone can vote, every registered voter can vote, and they can vote for any candidate on the ballot in any office in the primaries, and then the top two candidates, whether it's two Democrats, two Republicans, Green, whatever, move on to the general election. That's better for the voters, But I have some reservations about that, because in a big state like California, in a state like New Hampshire or Maine, that would be fine. But in a state like California, where we have these multi-million dollar campaigns, what it takes to run statewide, you know, at least under the current system, if you're an independent candidate, a green candidate, a small party candidate, you can collect a fairly modest number of signatures and get on the ballot. But you don't stand a chance in a top two system. They've also adopted redistricting reform. They had a citizens commission in California this time. And I think that we'll see how it works out in the primaries in general. But it looks to me like it's a pretty good system compared to what most states have. You had to apply. There were an equal number of Republicans, Democrats, and independents, and citizens, and they drew the map. And there were a lot of districts that were competitive. And David Dreyer, the sitting Republican member of the House Rules Committee, is retiring because he would have had to compete in a competitive district. So we'll see. I think that looks pretty good in terms of reform. In states where you have ballot initiatives, and Ohio I talked to a citizen when I was in Ohio, and she's going to work on something like that for redistricting reform to get it on the ballot this fall. You could do that in Maine. That's a good project for one of you when you graduate. I also talk about, I know a number of people, you have a campaign finance class, I guess, and that's a tough, that's an intractable problem. Money always finds a way. So campaign finance reform is a tough one. Just show up and testify and call and write your elected officials and support candidates who are willing to offer solutions and not just the same old rhetoric. And, again, in this day and age, you can blog, you can start your own groups, your own citizen groups, student groups. If you like groups like the Coffee Party or No Labels or something, you can join them. So, we'll see. The big question is, will the independent voters get off the couch? And I don't know the answer to that question. So.
I actually had a very similar question to Justin regarding the higher percentage of independents among younger people.
Mm-hmm.
I guess what I would prefer to get at is, how does it compare historically to rates among younger people? Has there always been more independents? Because in that case, I think it would indicate more that it's just people are undecided. However, if rates are rising of independents among younger people, perhaps that's indicative of a system that's broken and young people who are less
system. Rates of independents are rising sort of among all age
among
groups.
All age. Okay.
Relative to, I think, and again, I'm not a quantitative person, but the University of Michigan, the national election, American National Election Studies is probably the best quantitative, and it only goes back, I think.
40 years.
Yeah, so before then, I just don't think we have good monitors of this stuff, so it only goes back about 50 or 60 years. But it's at the highest level since they've been keeping track. Yeah.
We talked a little bit about Angus King at dinner.
Yes.
And if he does win, what type of role do you think he'd be able to play in the Senate?
I don't think young people watch public television in very high percentages talking about what young people do, but I'm going to be on Maine public television. Maine Watch, is it on tomorrow? It's on, she said three or four times. Yeah, and she asked me that question. And I think, she said, I think the Democrats are mad that Angus King is running, and I think they're trying to kind of badmouth him a little. And, I think some people are saying, well, he won't be effective, it'll be a wasted vote, blah, blah, blah. And I don't think that at all. I think he can totally have almost more of an impact as an independent, because he can decide who he caucuses with, so he can be a deciding vote. He can say no party is controlling him. He can vote with the Republicans on things if he thinks they're right, or work with them. He can go with the Democrats on things if he thinks they're right. Unlike Olympia Snowe, he won't have party leaders breathing down his neck or face a Tea Party challenge, you know? So I think he could be extremely effective, and part of it is also, and I have never met him, I gather he has a very pleasant personality, that he gets along with people. You know, if you compare him, let's say, to Joe Lieberman, who's an independent, who isn't that pleasant and wasn't that well liked. He was mad that he lost the primary, and that's why he became an independent. It wasn't for philosophical reasons. I mean, yes, he supported the war in Iraq, but he doesn't get along, he doesn't work and play well with others so much. You know, if Angus King can develop the relationships with his fellow senators, I think he could be very effective.
Let me defend political scientists for a moment. I don't want to take up Rui's argument, but I would like to talk about your 40% number and the assumption that you have that this is a monolithic 40%. I think the best interpretation of the 2010 election, by the way, the 40% is only a number if you include everybody as an independent who is in a state that doesn't allow you to register mm-hmm. in party affiliation. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, mm-hmm. it's if you look at the states that do allow party affiliation, it's less than a third are independents and more Democrats and Republicans. So in some ways, that's a false number. But even with that number, if you take the 40%, the assumption that they're monolithic seems to me very difficult to sustain.
Yes, no, I agree, yeah.
The best interpretation I know of the 2010 election is that most of the Tea Party people in 2008 would have been called your independents because they weren't Republicans. They became Republicans in 2008 in response partly to the Affordable Health Care Act and to the congressional meetings that went on during that summer. And in Maine, where we have a very long history of independent voters, they are independent voters of the left and of the right, mm-hmm. much more than they are of the center. This mm-hmm. is the Jonathan Carter following, the Buddy Franklin following, for people in Maine who know, who are much more ideological in many ways, and they reject Olympia Snowe, and they reject moderate Democrats like John Baldacci because they are moderates and they want somebody at the two extremes. So I'm not sure where the great hope for this independent mm-hmm. swelling is as moderate. And just one more point. Joe Lieberman, you described Joe Lieberman exactly correctly, except for who he did play well with was Republicans
yeah,
when he was a Democrat.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
he was
yeah.
right in the center. That was his problem.
Yeah. But they don't like him either. They don't trust him. I mean, I rode back on a bus. There are like four questions in there, so I'll have to try to remember them. I should have written them down. I went to the 2008 conventions, and just by some quirk, because there are buses that run from the convention hall to the hotels, and I got on a bus at the Republican convention, and it was full of these, like, Republicans. And it was the night that Joe Lieberman gave his speech, and they were just, what the hell? Why did we have to hear from Joe Lieberman? I mean, you know, the Republicans didn't like him either. But okay, so all of your questions. So, okay, and that's not what Teixeira said. That's not what he said. He said they're all predictable and they're aligned with one party or the other. They're not monolithic, and you're right. And this is something that also I get a question almost every time I speak about, or somebody calls in and someone says, I'm a libertarian, or someone says, I'm a progressive, but I'm also an independent voter. So it's absolutely true that they're all over the spectrum. They're independent, so they're all over the spectrum. I chose to focus in the book on the centrists because, to me, those are who the swing voters are. Because, to me, the progressives are almost never going to vote for a Republican, and the libertarians are going to rarely vote for a Democrat. They might vote for an independent candidate, but whereas the center are the people who swing. And the way I got my 20%, you're right about the states and the registration, and what can I say? Gallup says it's 40%. I say it's 40%, the independent voters. But of that 40%, the way I got the 20, the book that Teixeira cited also has higher than 20%. I did that in my rebuttal to him that was on the Daily Beast. But the another place where the 20% is Pew, and their polling on independent voters, their most recent poll was when the book came out, so it was probably a 2010 poll. They asked independent voters, in the last 5 years, have you either consistently voted for or been aligned with either the Democrats or Republicans? And 20% and half of the independent voters said no. In the last 5 years, I haven't been. So that's where I got the 20%. It's hard. It's not an exact science. You know, it's hard to exactly, because these people are all over the map, and they swing, and they change. And one election, they're aligned with the Democrats, and one election, they're aligned with the Republicans. And, you know, so that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Linda, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine here on MPBN Radio. Today's speaker was Linda Killian, a journalist and a senior scholar at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Her talk was entitled The Swing Vote, The Untapped Power of the Independent. She recently spoke at the Goldfarb Center at Colby College in Waterville. Linda Killian was also on last week's Maine Watch, which you can find online at mpbn.net by going to television and then on demand. If you'd like to purchase a taped copy of today's Speaking in Maine, please call MPBN's Audience Services Department at 1-800-884-1717. Again, for a copy of today's Speaking in Maine with Linda Killian, the number to call is 1-800-884-1717. You can also listen to this program again at any time by accessing it on our website, mpbn.net. Click on Audio on Demand or Podcast to access this program, as well as many other archived Speaking in Maine programs. Charles Beck is the executive producer of this series. For Speaking in Maine, I'm Lindsay Maynard.